Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Lisa Graves of the Center for Media and Democracy, who examines the relationship between the National Rifle Association and the American Legislative Exchange Council and the firearms public policy agenda of both organizations. Matt Wall of the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, who talks about the broad coalition of progressive groups and legislators who oppose President Obama's fiscal cliff offer of a chain CPI cut to Social Security benefits. And Justin Mazzola of Amnesty International USA, who discusses his group's concerns in the case of imprisoned Native American activist Leonard Peltier and the work being done to advocate for his release. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Rare earth minerals are little-known elements that are key components in smartphones and other advanced electronics. These minerals are especially useful as magnets in lasers, as well as in hybrid and electric car batteries. The downside of rare earth minerals is they produce a dangerous trail of toxic waste. Much of the damage can be seen near refineries in Asia. Radioactive elements like thorium and uranium develop alongside rare earth minerals and are difficult to separate in the refining process. At an Inner Mongolian rare earth refinery, toxins leached into nearby waterways and irrigation canals. More than 66 deaths have been linked to radioactive waste there, according to Mother Jones magazine. The Asian rare earth company in Malaysia, co-owned by Mitsubishi Chemical, was the target of protesters in the 1980s and 90s. People there were angry about the health effects and damage to the environment produced by untreated plant waste. When the plant was eventually shut down, the company left a toxic time bomb of 80,000 drums of radioactive thorium hydroxide. Despite the toxic mess and links to birth defects and childhood diseases like leukemia, Malaysia was eager to attract more investment from the rare earth industry. The government recently approved a plan by an Australian company, the Lynas Corporation, to build a huge plant that would generate tons of toxic waste. The project, the largest proposed rare earth refinery in the world, will send its polluted wastewater into the fertile fishing grounds of the South China Sea. The streets are calmer in El Salvador's gritty barrios since a truce was signed by two of the Central American nation's most violent gangs in March. The country's murder rate has fallen by half, and gangs are disarming in selected cities as part of a mediation process. Since the 1992 peace treaty that ended El Salvador's bloody civil war, governments have tried and failed to rein in violent gangs, including invoking a 2009 law making it illegal to belong to a gang. The offensive against gangs only led to prison overcrowding and more violence. According to the Christian Science Monitor, there are over 64,000 gang members in El Salvador, a small country of 6 million people. The leadership of the most powerful gangs, 18th Street and Mara Salvatrucha 13, or MS-13, had come from Los Angeles after they were deported back to El Salvador in the 1990s. Initially, leftist President Mauricio Funes tried the get-tough approach against violent gangs, especially after the 18th Street gang shot up a bus, killing 17 people in June of 2010. Later, the government launched secret talks with gang leaders mediated by Catholic Monsignor Fabio Colindres and former legislator and guerrilla leader Raul Mihango. In early December, phase two of the peace process began when five gangs agreed to cease all activity in selected zones of peace in 10 municipalities. The Chicago teacher strike in September was often framed in the media as a personality clash between strong-willed Mayor Rahm Emanuel and dynamic union president Karen Lewis. But this narrative missed the untold story of rank and file power among classroom teachers who crafted union strategy and extended the strike 2 days in order to debate the contract settlement. Karen Lewis, a chemistry teacher, rode an insurgent wave in 2010 to be elected president of the Chicago Teachers Union. She promised to turn the CTU into a democratic union responsive to its members. Rank and file workers led 14 key union committees, which set the day-to-day operations of the union. The CTU led a popular summer organizing initiative where thousands of labor activists knocked on union members' doors to talk about key workplace issues. According to the news magazine, in these times, the grassroots approach helped build broad public support for the teachers' strike, especially among parents of public school students and the city's Black and Latino residents. After the strike ended on September 18th, 79% of teachers voted to ratify a new 3-year contract in early October. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
A week before the December 14th shooting rampage that ended the lives of 20 children and 6 adults in Newtown, Connecticut, the National Rifle Association broke its self-imposed silence with a public statement issued by NRA CEO Wayne LaPierre. The press conference was twice disrupted by anti-NRA activists with the group Code Pink Women for Peace, whose members held up signs which read, "NRA blood on its hands" and "NRA killing our kids." During the media event, the NRA reiterated its opposition to new gun control laws and blamed mass shooting incidents on America's entertainment industry, violent movies, and video games. LaPierre stated that the massacre at Newtown's Sandy Hook Elementary School, committed by Adam Lanza using an AR-15 semi-automatic assault rifle, could have been prevented or stopped if there had been armed, trained security personnel on site, and went on to say that the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. There was widespread pushback against the NRA position and advocacy of new laws to ban assault weapons, high-capacity ammunition magazines, as well as 100% background checks for everyone who purchases a gun. Your reporter spoke with Lisa Graves, executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy, who formerly served as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Legal Policy at the U.S. Department of Justice, where she worked on national gun policy. Here she examines the relationship between the National Rifle Association and the American Legislative Exchange Council and the firearms public policy agenda of both organizations.
Well, I found Wayne LaPierre's press conference on Friday to be bizarre and really tone-deaf. I think the notion that we can prevent these awful tragedies by having more guns in our schools is really wrong-headed. And quite frankly, he's ignoring history. In the terrible tragedy in Columbine in Colorado, there was an armed guard at that school, and he took a shot at the shooters. But that didn't stop the shooters. The shooters were still able to get into the school and murder those children. And I think that if you think about it just logically, you can't have a gunman, in essence, a volunteer or a paid guard in every single classroom, in every single school, in every single town and city in the country. It's an absurd suggestion, and quite frankly, it's not the only absurd thing he said. This is a man who stood there before the American people and basically said, guns don't kill people, video games do. You know, a video game has never pierced a person's heart. A gun has. And in this instance, as everyone knows all too well, a young man was able to murder 20 children in a matter of seconds, if not minutes. And so I think that Wayne LaPierre has signaled that his alliance is with the most extreme elements of the gun society in this country. And he's certainly doing the bidding of his real masters, which are one of the primary funders of the National Rifle Association, which are corporations. The NRA is both a membership organization of some gun owners in the United States, as well as a corporation that a nonprofit corporation that represents some of the biggest gun manufacturers in the world, like a trade group. When you look at the amount of money that the NRA has, it spends well over $100 million a year. It has well over $100 million in assets beyond what it spends a year. And it pays a corporate-style salary. Wayne LaPierre gets paid nearly $1 million a year, including salary and benefits, to be a front man for the weapons industry, quite frankly, in my opinion.
Lisa, your organization, the Center for Media and Democracy, has done extensive research and investigation of the American Legislative Exchange Council, otherwise known as ALEC. Tell us a little bit about the role ALEC has played in extending the influence of the NRA on gun policy in this country. And it would be important to also explain the NRA's relationship with ALEC.
This is a group that exists in large part, I would say primarily, to push legislation into law. And what it does is it creates an equal partnership where, under its own literature, corporations get a voice and a vote on these bills. Then these bills are brought back to the state houses in capitals across the country, and these ALEC legislators introduce these bills cleansed of any reference to the fact that they were pre-voted on by corporations, some of the biggest corporations and special interests in the world, like the NRA. The NRA has been a long-time member of ALEC. It was the chair of ALEC's crime task force. It was even the chair of ALEC's public safety and elections task force a few years ago when ALEC decided that it was going to make it harder for Americans to vote through restrictive voting measures, through restrictive voter ID rules. So the NRA and ALEC go way back. That legacy is quite startling.
And to put the question bluntly, Lisa, specifically, who benefits financially from the NRA's opposition to almost all gun control legislation? And this despite the fact there's been polling of the membership of the NRA, which generally supports some of the common sense gun control laws that have been proposed both before and after the Newtown tragedy.
Who profits from these NRA ALEC laws? The gun manufacturers and the gun dealers and the gun sellers. They are the ones who profit from these types of measures. And who profits from the NRA's efforts to thwart reasonable protections, reasonable public safety measures about handguns? It's the gun industry. And that gun industry is a global industry. Some of these companies are foreign companies, foreign-held holding companies and other companies. They sell a number of weapons to the U.S. military, and then they sell civilian-grade weapons that are similar to military-grade weapons, and weapons like the Bushmaster with a 30-bullet clip. It's not a hunting weapon. It's a weapon for war. It's a weapon for killing people and for killing them as quickly as you can. And so those are the types of weapons, and those types of clips, access to those weapons and clips are one of the chief objectives that the NRA has pushed over the years in its efforts to thwart the original assault weapons ban and to ensure that it expired. And that goes for both the regular Bushmaster and other semi-automatic types of weapons with these large clips of ammunition.
That was Lisa Graves, Executive Director of the Center for Media and Democracy. For more analysis and commentary on the public policy debate over gun control, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In a rare public demonstration of political weakness, Republican Speaker of the House John Boehner was forced to abandon legislation he called Plan B. The proposed tax package up for a vote on December 20th was designed to put Republicans on the record as acting to prevent an automatic rise in taxes on the majority of Americans on January 1st, while allowing rates to go up on those making $1 million or more. In the end, the Republican leader could not muster enough support for the bill, where many in his caucus oppose all tax increases, some out of fear that right-wing Tea Party groups would mount primary challenges against them during the next election cycle. President Obama, too, has seen a revolt among progressive Democrats, angered that he had offered Republicans a controversial change to the way cost-of-living adjustments are made to Social Security benefits as part of a grand bargain fiscal cliff deal. Chain CPI, as the proposed cost-of-living index is known, would, according to economists, reduce benefits for the average 65-year-old by $6,000 in the first 15 years of retirement and $16,000 over 25 years. Before Congress adjourned for the Christmas holiday, Mr. Obama had also retreated from his original demand for an increase in tax rates on those making more than $250,000 a year, upward to those with an annual income of more than $400,000. But with the nation set to go over the fiscal cliff on the first day of the new year, ushering in an automatic $500 billion in tax hikes and $109 billion in domestic and Pentagon spending cuts, there will be pressure to reach a deal, even a short-term agreement, to put off tough decisions until later in the year. Your reporter spoke with Matt Wall, press associate with the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, who talks about the broad coalition of progressive groups and legislators who oppose President Obama's fiscal cliff offer of a chain CPI cut to Social Security benefits.
Well, what we just saw most recently this week was Speaker Boehner's failure to pass his so-called Plan B. And that really shows that any deal that does come out will need many Democratic votes to pass. So right now, House Democrats and Democrats in the Senate have a lot of leverage in these negotiations. And so as we get closer to the deadline, we're going to see either a much better deal or no deal at all, because Speaker Boehner has really lost a lot of leverage in the last few days. The Progressive Change Campaign Committee and our partners in MoveOn.org, AFL-CIO, Social Security Works, and a host of other organizations are working to make sure that in whatever deal happens, there are no cuts to Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid benefits. And we've been organizing with our allies in Congress to make sure that any deal that is made does not have those cuts.
President Obama angered many progressive members of Congress and activists across the country when he offered a deal to Republican Speaker John Boehner that included something called chain CPI, a method of calculating the cost of living adjustments in Social Security and other benefit programs, and this was meant to save many billions of dollars. Chain CPI, as I understand it, would have over time resulted in substantial cuts to Social Security benefits. Why do you think the president offered to cut Social Security, and what's the status of that offer right now?
You know, I think what we're seeing is the president is going too far in offering cuts to Republicans. Chain CPI is a very bad idea. It is a cut to Social Security benefits, and it also hurts a lot of other people, including veterans, which use the same formula as Social Security to get their benefit. I think with John Boehner's failure to get Plan B and the deadline looming ever closer, we're going to see, hopefully, things like that taken off the table, because cuts to Medicare, cuts to Social Security, and cuts to Medicaid are really unacceptable. And so hopefully the president will take those off the table. And if he doesn't, progressives will oppose any deal that has them. And we're whipping members right now to make sure that's the case. And so I think, like in 2011, in that fiscal showdown, we're going to see these bad options taken back off the table. And ultimately, we're going to have a better deal if we go over the deadline.
Explain to our listeners a bit about why missing the January 1st deadline for the fiscal cliff will empower House Democrats, House Progressive Democrats in particular, to get a better deal after this deadline is gone.
After this deadline passes, a lot of the things that the Republicans are trying to negotiate with will have already happened. The tax rates will have gone up, and a lot of the things that the Republicans are using as bargaining chips, like these tax rates, will no longer be available. And the House and Senate that are coming in are much more progressive. You see senators like Elizabeth Warren and Chris Murphy in Connecticut replacing more conservative senators like Joe Lieberman. So we're going to have a more progressive Senate. There's going to be more Democrats and better Democrats in the House. And a lot of the things that we want are already going to be law. And so those things that we don't want will be able to be changed once Congress is in session. A lot of the spending cuts and some of the things that have expired. So we'll already have the tax increases, and all the rest will be able to work with a much more progressive House and a much more progressive Senate.
That was Matt Wall, press associate with the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. Find more perspectives on President Obama's position on the fiscal cliff negotiations and entitlement reform on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Imprisoned Native American activist Leonard Peltier was the focus of a benefit concert hosted by legendary folk singer Pete Seeger and singer-actor Harry Belafonte. The December 14th political gathering at New York City's Beacon Theater, titled Bring Leonard Peltier Home in 2012, included appearances by singer-songwriters Bruce Coburn and Jackson Brown, actors Danny Glover and Peter Coyote, as well as Oglala Sioux Nation tribal leaders and hip-hop artists Common and Mos Def. Peltier, a member of the American Indian Movement, was arrested after two FBI agents, Jack Kohler and Ronald Williams, were killed in a 1975 shootout on the Pine Ridge Lakota Sioux Reservation in South Dakota. Peltier's supporters have long maintained that the case was tainted by judicial misconduct and lack of evidence. The Native American activist was convicted of aiding and abetting in the murders of the FBI agents and sentenced to two consecutive life terms. Peltier has been in prison for 37 years, and because he's now in failing health, the concert was organized to raise consciousness about the case and to urge President Obama to free the ailing activist before Christmas. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Justin Mazzola, a researcher with Amnesty International USA, a group which has followed Peltier's case since he was illegally extradited from Canada in 1976. U.S. law enforcement officials, specifically the FBI, has lobbied intensely against ordering a new trial for Peltier, the granting of parole or clemency. Here, Mazzola describes Amnesty's concerns in the case and how the organization is currently working for Peltier's release.
Amnesty's position is that, you know, we remain seriously concerned about the fairness of the proceedings that took place leading up to Mr. Peltier's conviction, and we believe that political factors may have influenced the way that the case was prosecuted. As has always been the case, we've been seeking his release based on all these different grounds, all these different questions, and that in the interest of justice and humanitarian grounds, the U.S. should release him.
What are some of the specifics that Amnesty is concerned about?
So in terms of the extradition from Canada, where Leonard Peltier had fled soon after the shootings, was based on the eyewitness testimony of Myrtle Poorbear, who I believe said that she was the girlfriend of Mr. Peltier, and that she had witnessed him shooting the two FBI agents. And she soon recanted, after the extradition was achieved, she soon recanted and said that she was basically pressured by the FBI and giving those statements. And she was then, at trial, never allowed to be called as a witness by the defense to refute some of the claims that were made. The other issue that came up in trial as well was that it actually came up during the appeals process and the evidentiary hearing that a FBI telex, which basically stated that the ballistics did not match Mr. Peltier's weapon and the firing pin that was found in Mr. Peltier's weapon did not match, and that was actually suppressed at the original trial and never given to the jury during the initial trial itself. And so between that, the suppression of information, and the fact that also the two other men who were brought to trial before Mr. Peltier were actually acquitted on the basis of self-defense by a jury, showing similar circumstances, similar issues.
In an interview right after the concert that Amy Goodman did with Leonard Peltier, he noted that the prosecutor in his case, Lynn Crooks, has admitted that the government didn't prove he killed the agents. And Crooks then said that Leonard is guilty of aiding and abetting, yet he's still sitting in jail after all these decades. How can that be?
I actually didn't quite understand that either when I saw that. My understanding was that he was sentenced to 2 consecutive life sentences for the 2 murders. I know that in the appeals they did mention the issue about aiding and abetting, but I thought it was more in the context of with the new information that had come out in terms of the suppressed information related to the firing pin and the weapon and ballistics and all that, that at most he could have been convicted. If it had gone back to jury, that one of the judges had said that most he would have been convicted of aiding and abetting.
Justin Mazzola, has Peltier actually been adopted by Amnesty as a prisoner of conscience?
I don't believe as a specific prisoner of conscience. We're really concerned about the judicial proceedings and how those took place and whether or not he received a fair trial. It's a slightly different designation than a prisoner of conscience. We don't use the term political prisoners, but we do note that there may have been some political influence or factors that may have influenced the way in which the case was prosecuted.
All of his legal options are exhausted. So without clemency, what's the future for Leonard Peltier?
The next parole date is 2024. So, and considering that he does suffer from some health concerns, including diabetes, he just was recently transferred to a new facility in Florida. And so, yes, unless, you know, he receives a release on humanitarian grounds from the president, his next chance at any kind of action on his case would be the 2024 parole hearing. I did actually speak with a man named Len Foster, who is Mr. Peltier's spiritual advisor, and had been visiting him and a number of Native American men and women who are in federal prison across the country for the past 27 years. When I spoke to Mr. Foster in May, he said that, you know, he is having issues in terms of his health is starting to really deteriorate, and that he might not be getting all the exercise that he needs, especially with a condition like diabetes, which is so important.
What specifically at this point is Amnesty doing on Peltier's case? I know you've been covering it, working on it for decades, but what's happening now?
We're continuing to put the pressure on public authorities, including the president, to release him. And so, you know, we've been working with his attorney as well as the Leonard Peltier support group that's been formed and trying to coordinate with them, promoting information that they're putting out, as well as, you know, whatever pressure we can put on the U.S. government, especially at this time of year. And I think that was why the concert was put on in December, because it's usually the end of the year and the end of the term or administration for a president when they grant clemency and pardons and those types of things. So, you know, we're continuing to put pressure on the president and government to actually release Leonard.
That was Justin Mazzola of Amnesty International USA. For more information on Peltier's case and the organizations working to free the Native American activist, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.